Hello.
Michael.
Hi, Graham.
It's Graham. How are you doing? I'm sorry I'm a little late. My previous interview went a little long.
I understand completely. So I've got a very short time with you. So I just want to ask you just a few questions about this. So in the 1920s, 50 years before you recorded Deja Vu, what was popular was Heebie-Jeebie by Louis Armstrong, Downhearted Blues by Bessie Smith, Ain't Misbehaving by Fats Waller, Black and Tan Fantasy, Duke Ellington, C.C. Wright by Ma Rainey, Swanee by Al Jolson. So that's great stuff, but it sounds really old. So even when you recorded your album 50 years earlier, it was very old. So what do you think? Deja Vu does not sound old to me. What do you think a kid today hears when he hears this record?
I think you will hear four people in the studio with a drummer and a bass player that are trying their best to enable you to shake your ass and think at the same time. It was a chaotic album to make. The differences basically were emotional. When we made the first Crosby, Stills and Nash record, it was sunny, it was partly acoustic, it was an uplifting kind of sound. I was in love and living with Joni Mitchell. Stephen was in love with Judy Collins. David was in love with his girlfriend Christine.
Yeah.
By the time we got to Deja Vu, it was pretty rocky between Joni and I. Stephen and Judy had broken up, and Christine had been killed in a car crash. So emotionally, we were at a completely different place than we were a year earlier.
And then you bring Neil Young into that mix.
Yes.
Was he really there for most of it, or did he kind of do his stuff on a different tape and bring it in? It sounds like he was kind of doing two things at once.
He was, as Neil usually is. When we were first rehearsing CSNY at Stephen's house in Laurel Canyon, after the sessions, Neil would go into the studio and be making After the Gold Rush. So yes, Neil was doing two things at once. He did play in the studio with us, of course, on stuff like Woodstock and Everybody I Love You and Helpless, of course. But normally he would take, Country Girl and take him to his studio and mess with them and just bring us back a track to sing voices to. So he was both there and not there at the same time.
But did he feel like he was part of the group, or did it feel like he was just sort of an added attraction?
That's when we began to realize who Neil was.
Yeah.
Neil is a brilliant musician, of course, but he is a complete slave to the muse of music. When Neil is feeling comfortable and the music's good, he puts 150% of effort into it. But when it's not feeling good and it's awkward and disjointed, he's out of the door. And we began to realize who Neil was.
Well, Stephen must have known that from Buffalo Springfield days, to a certain degree.
Yes, he did. And that's one of the reasons why, David and Stephen had dinner in New York with Ahmet Erdogan, who was the CEO of Atlantic Records and our dear friend. And in the middle of dinner with David and Stephen, Ahmet said, "I don't think you should get, man." And Stephen said, "Okay, Ahmet, who do you think we should get? We have to get somebody because of this." On that first CSN record, Stephen played most of the instruments. Now, of course, David and I played rhythm guitar on our stuff, but Stephen played lead guitar, rhythm guitar, bass guitar, piano, B3, percussion. He played most of the instruments, right? So when you come to the end of that record and we realized it was probably going to be a big hit, then we realized we probably would have to go on the road, and then we realized, what the hell are we going to do when you played most of the instruments? So Stephen and David actually went to England, and they asked Stevie Winwood if he wanted to join us. And Stevie was on his own trip right then and didn't want to be a part of it. And so he then went to Jimi Hendrix and asked Jimi if he wanted to join it. And Jimi said, "No, man, I got my own thing going, and you guys just played that beautiful Western sky music."
Yeah. How would that have worked? How do you think it would have worked out if Jimi Hendrix had joined the group? I can't see that. Could you see that?
Sure. Yeah, I can definitely see it. You know, there was a there was an album put out by Paul McCartney's brother Michael and John McGough called McGough McGear, and it was called Lily the Pink. And it was an album that, you know, Paul's brother was making. So, of course, there were a lot of people there. You know, I was there, Jimmy was there, Dave Mason was there. We all sang on that record, and it was very interesting. So, yeah, I do think that that we would have made very interesting music with Hendrix.
Oh, definitely interesting. So I saw a documentary about the making of the album, with, and there was an interview with Bill Halverson, the engineer. And he said, like, Stephen was very busy, even on the Deja Vu. Like, he basically produced the record and wanted to do everything. Is that your recollection?
He didn't produce the record. We all did. But yes, Stephen really, really. I mean, he even designed the cover. You know, that was Stephen's idea. So
that was a weird cover, man. I never got that cover. I never understood why. Why you guys wanted to dress up in Civil War outfits. I know why the band did it. You know, they had a song that related to the Civil War, so I never saw that. And then the graphics were all computer code. What was that?
How do you mean computer code?
The graphics of the writing. It kind of looks like early computer code.
Really?
That's what it looks like to me.
Interesting. Anyway, that was Stephen's idea, and that's why we got Neil, was because we had to get somebody to, because Stephen, you know, played, as I said, played most of the instruments on that first record.
I just think of Neil Young saying, I gotta wear this kind of, I gotta put these outfits on and stand around looking like I'm in the Civil War.
You'll notice that me and Neil and David are not in Civil War. It's only really Stephen that has a Civil War-ish jacket in. So we weren't dressed, or we were dressed as we normally would.
Okay, that's interesting too. So the voices on the record are all blended together in one track, as opposed to being spread out, which is something that was done at that period of time. Is that because you all decided that you were like a force of nature combined together, and that if it had been spread out where you could hear each individual voice, it would have ruined the blend, or was it just an engineering choice? Do you know?
Yeah, I do know. What we wanted to do, particularly on the first Crosby, Stills, and Nash record, was to create a unique harmony. You've got to understand, anyone can sing the same notes that me and David and Stephen sing. The only thing is, you cannot sound like me and David and Stephen when we put our three voices and make them into one.
Yeah, well, that is an individual thing that blends together and really shouldn't be separated apart.
I agree.
And it works really, really well. So, reading the history of this, where Neil Young was standing out driving by and he had his guitar and David Crosby, the whole scenario of how this all came together is kind of like mythical. So, and you lived through it. So, did it feel that way to you, or was it just like an everyday thing that was happening?
No, it was an everyday thing. We were musicians, and we had songs, and we had, you know, the ability to book a studio and engineer and tape. We were on top of the world. We were having a great time. But we never really realized that 50 years later, you and I would be talking about this.
That's the point. That all these years later, people would still be talking about it. And loving that record. It is hard to believe that happened, and it continues to this day.
It sounds better than the original album, because, of course, the mastering technology 50 years later is much different than it was when we first did that record. So, to me, it sounds way better than the original album.
Yeah, it is definitely in sharper focus. And even the outtakes and the demo stuff, it sounds like you're right in my room.
We wanted it to be that way.
Yeah, it sounds really, really good. It's very exciting, especially the new stuff, because the regular record is like encased in my brain for 50 years. So.
Right.
All right, I guess I've taken about as much time as I should take. Is anything else you want to tell my listeners about this, my readers?
Yeah. I just wanted them to understand how we were, how the four of us were emotionally at the time that we made the Deja Vu record. It was chaotic. Yes, there were drugs involved. Yes, there were all-night sessions. Yes, there were sessions that lasted for 2 days. We know all that. We just wanted people to enjoy this record. I'll give you a perfect example. There's a version of Our House where Joni and I are playing the piano and singing. And I, in my memory, it was from the Philadelphia Music Academy during a sound check. But normally, you would never hear that on a record because it's imperfect. It's a great moment, and I wanted to for people who are fans of the Deja Vu record to know where we were emotionally, and that's a great indication.
And you have an anniversary coming up for your solo album, right? It's around the same time, right?
Yes, indeed. Yep.
Are you going to make a big to-do about that too?
I'm talking this Deja Vu record was not put together by me and David and Stephen and Neil. This was put together by Patrick Milligan from Rhino Records and my best friend of all time, Joel Bernstein,
right.
Who was an artist.
I know Joel, yeah.
Yeah, so it was Joel and Patrick that sent all the stuff to us to be able to give our opinion about what should be on the record. So I must give props to Joel and to Patrick. But we wanted people who are fans of this record to really enjoy it, and that's why that Our House thing with me and Joni where we screw up in the middle and I think I even say shit, you know, and we start laughing. You would normally never hear that.
Right.
But I just thought it was so indicative of how we were doing that I wanted to put it on.
I'm glad you let that come out, because I think the whole thing adds more backdrop to the whole thing, which I think is useful. It's also useful to have when you screw up to let people hear it. It's not a problem, I don't think.
No, it was not a problem for us.
So they presented this to you as almost a finished package, and you had no input on it. You just had the input of including that take.
Yeah, we had the music to deal with, and also the packaging was going to be a reproduction of the original. So there was not a lot of stuff that needed to be done except the musical choices.
And did you read Cameron Crowe's recollection of the whole thing and history of it?
Of course.
Is it all accurate?
Of course. Is it all accurate? Most of it. He spent a lot of time talking about Stephen's idea of that, here's what happened. I was in London. I came to Los Angeles to spend 3 days with Joni. I got to Joni's house in the yellow cab. I took my guitar and my suitcase out of the cab, realized that there were other voices going on in the house. I didn't like that. I just wanted to be with Joni. But it was David and Steve. And they were having dinner with Joan, and obviously, everything was fine. We smoked a big one. David said to Stephen, hey, play Willie, that song that we've been working on. Because the Springfield had broken up and David had been thrown out of the Birds, they were trying to get a kind of an Everly Brother kind of thing together.
Sure.
And so they were working on a song, two-part, and it was the song You Don't Have to Cry of Stephen Stills.
Yeah.
They played the song. I looked at him. I said, that's a great, great song. Do me a favor, play it one more time. They looked at each other. They shrugged. They played it again. They got to the end. I said, all right, bear with me. One more time. And in the first two times that they'd done it, I learned the words, I'd learned the body language, I'd learned the breathing techniques of each of my partners, and I had my part down, and 45 seconds into singing You Don't Have to Cry in three-part, we burst out laughing because we had discovered something unbelievably unique. Now then, that was how that went. Stephen said that we played it the day before in Cass's kitchen. That can't possibly be true because the day before I was in London.
So
that's the only part of Cameron's essay that I disagree with.
And you jumped right in and sang it, and had the word. That's amazing.
It's amazing. Can you believe what we? I gotta understand. The Buffalo Springfield and the Hollies and the Birds were decent harmony bands.
Yeah.
But this was something unique.
But you were like the only normal person in this whole situation. Where you were just like a guy who could step in and do this. All these other giant egos. I'm not sure you got a big ego if you could jump in like that. But these guys were like fighting and having issues. And you were just like a calm ocean in there?
because I'd heard the possibility of great music being made. And yeah. You can't show me great music and then stop. Yeah. With me, if you make great music, what's the next song? What's the next song? What's the next song? That's what I want. I want the music to get done.
So could there ever be one final reunion where everybody gets together and does it?
I'll never say no, because we've been at this point in our lives several times, as you well know. But I think it's done. And if I might get metaphorical for just a moment, I believe that there's a silver thread that joins people of like minds, particularly musicians and artists. That silver thread is very flexible, and it moves and it bends and it curls, etc. But once that silver thread is broken, it's very difficult to put it back together.
Yeah,
that's what's going on with me and David.
Yeah, which is sad, especially because everybody's still alive, which a lot of groups don't have.
That's right. We're probably the only super group, you know, for want of a better word, that is still have all the original members. The Grateful Dead, the Rolling Stones, the Beach Boys.
Mm-mm. Yep. You're the only ones.
Yep.
Oh, well, I saw David Crosby in some interview. He said, yeah, I was an asshole. I am an asshole. And at least he admits it.
Yeah, but you know something? Would you like an asshole in your life?
No, I've had enough of those
Thank
myself.
Yeah, and there you go.
And you have it on. At least you have the good stuff on record, and it's it will last forever, as far as I can tell.
50-odd years of great music.
Yeah, just like that stuff from the 1920s is still great music. It still is.
And you'll notice that a lot of those people were black. Every single person you mentioned about the 1920s music with Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith, etc., they were all black.
Yep.
And the only one that wasn't black was a white man that had blackface.
Yeah, Al Jolson. Yep.
You got it.
Yep.
Wild, eh?
Amazing. All right, listen, thanks for taking so much time with me. I appreciate catching up with you. The last time I spoke to you was backstage in Tarrytown, I think. So.
Ah, yes. Oh, that was a nice show.
Yeah, that was a great show. Yeah, we both enjoyed that very much. All right. Are you enjoying New York City? Are you enjoying living in New York?
I am. It's a great city, this.
Yep.
You've got to be on your guard, though.
Hopefully it'll all come back now.
Yes.
Okay, man. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Michael. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.